Tarry here, where the stories never grow old, and you hear something new every time they are told and it comes clear. So tarry here, where it doesn't matter your age, and when we gather round the table, we all take the stage year after year. So tarry here.
Welcome to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. This is your sparring partners, Fanny Crawford.
And Stacy Okowski, and it's so good to see your smiling face on a Monday morning.
And we are back after a whole month away.
Yes.
My goodness gracious.
Well, actually only 3 weeks.
And some days. Okay.
Yeah.
And today is Monday, April
a month, you're right.
29th, 2024. And our theme today is the poetry of astronomy. And if you're not sure what that means, audience, stay tuned, because we are going to figure that out as we tell stories.
Whoa.
Today, we're celebrating International Astronomy Day and Poetry Month. And that's how we got to the poetry of astronomy. At least that's my version of the story.
There you go.
How have you been for the past month, Stasz Zielkowski?
Busy. We moved my brother.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
It was, and it is. So when, boy. Starting at the beginning of April, we were notified that we could get a room for my brother in this wonderful assisted living place in Martinsburg, which would save us a 200-mile round trip 3 or 4 times a month to Baltimore to take my brother to the VA and to visit him. And we had done that for 31 months. And I don't think we ever went longer than I think maybe 14, 15 days was the longest time in between our visits. But sometimes we visited them 3, 4 times in a month. And there were a couple of times where we wind up staying overnight because he had things 2 days in a row. And that's, anyway, so we finally got him moved in on April the 6th. And on April the 16th, he went in the hospital. So he had 9 wonderful days in this new assisted living place. He's not been back since. He was in the hospital. Then he was put into a rehab facility. During the time in the hospital, he had a heart attack. He actually had about 6 different episodes where he was gone, out. At one point, I was with him. He was in a wheelchair. I was wheeling him into the bathroom. He became straight as a board with his feet on the floor and his head back, thrown back. And I was holding him in my arms. And I thought I was saying goodbye to my brother. But he did open his eyes and he coughed and started breathing again. And then a nurse showed up and since then, he's in this rehab facility. He's getting some physical therapy. And it looks like his needs, his condition is so deteriorated that he may not be accepted back into his assisted living place. So that's where we are. And I've seen him every day since the 6th. I go to his facility and spend an hour or two with him. And we just sit and talk and laugh. He's in good spirits, amazingly. And it's kind of tough.
Yeah. So, well, I'm glad you're doing okay.
Yeah, I'm.
Best wishes to Tony, boy.
Yep, I'm chugging along. I'm on a walker now. except for like if I have a very short trip, like from the car 15 feet to a doorway or something, I take my walker, because where Tony is, the hallway, the length of the hallway from the front door to his room is an enormous walk. I did it with the cane the first time I went there. I thought I wasn't going to make it. And my legs have been giving me more and more of a fit. So, but I put a board on my walker so I'd have a seat, because he shares a room with another man, and the room is kind of small, you know, two hospital beds in a small room, two wheelchairs, because both of these guys are not able to move with their feet. And so when I go in there with my walker, I had stand up the first time I went there, and wound up leaning on his bed and then sitting on the end of his bed. It was a real comedy. So anyway,
you had stories.
Yeah, so I fashioned the board and made it so it fit just in the walker, and used the bungee cord to hold it in place. But then I found out, unless after I did that about a week ago, each time I go in, the board is not as wide as the entire walker or as deep. And so I'm sitting on a board that's about maybe 5 inches wide. And so it doesn't help me any, you know, my backside is getting sore. So then I put a pillow on it. We covered it with an old pair of the leg from an old pair of sweatpants, and I stapled it on and everything. It looked really good, but it's still too narrow. So today I'm going to fix the board so it's closer to the front. It'll be more comfortable for my tush.
Wow. Well, I want to thank Andy Alfred Irwin for opening our show this morning before we get too far into discussion. And I'm just realizing that I don't have my timer here with me. So I hope you are timing.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Go on.
Let me check here on my facility. Yeah, I do have a timer. And I believe that we've been on for 5 minutes already.
Yeah, it has been 5 minutes already.
Wow, okay. So that's okay. So, you know, we'll be able to kind of keep track, right? So
you've told us about your
challenge. How about you?
I'm doing fine. I'm in the process of closing out my flea market booth, and that's an adventure.
Wow.
Was there yesterday about 7 hours, and going back as soon as this radio show is over.
What are you doing with the stuff?
I'm taking it to various people with open arms all over the place.
I got an idea that works that we've used recently, a couple of things. Put it by the curb with a sign that says free.
We don't really have a curb. We live in a circle.
I know.
Not very many people come here.
Yeah, well.
But it's
I understand that. You're right. I know your neighborhood, so.
Yeah. But how about if we start with a story?
Sure. Okay. You want me to start?
Sure.
Wow. I usually say ladies first, but I'm ready to talk about the stars. All right. Let's see. Sort of a real story, as if I were in a classroom, I guess. For years, so many years. You know, it's amazing. I've been doing a lot of studying lately about astronomy, even though I taught astronomy, ran a planetarium. I love studying about the stars. I spent a great deal of time of recently reading two books about 16th and early 17th century, about mainly about four men. Copernicus, Tycho Brahe, Kepler, and Galileo. And in reading these books, they were, especially one of them, was about how they worked so hard to understand the motion of the planets, the motion of the sun, and the motion of the moon. And the amazing thing is that during their lifetimes, they were forbidden to believe that the sun moved. They were taught that that the earth was the center of the universe and the sun actually moved around the earth. And as, you know, basic scientists, even though in the rudimentary sense, because it was 500-600 years ago, a little bit more, and it didn't make sense to them that an object like the sun that had to be pretty far away could go around the earth once every 24 hours. It just didn't fit in their brain because it would have to be moving so incredibly fast. But they were stuck with the fact that even a kid could stand in the middle of a field and say, "See, Dad, it was right there this morning, and now it's up in the air. And later today, it'll be over in that side of the field, and then tonight it goes down on the other side." And it was pretty hard to try to tell somebody, "No, no, no, that can't be possible." Anyway, so they did all kinds of things. And in studying their efforts, it gave me a headache. It actually gave me four headaches. One for Copernicus, one for Brahe, one for Kepler, and a big one for Galileo, of course. Galileo was chastised by the church and was made to say in front and kneel in the church and say that the earth was the center of the universe and that the sun anyway. And then amazingly, it only took the Catholic Church through the voice of the Pope 350 years on the nose, 350 years, not until 1992 did the Roman Catholic Vicar of Christ in the Catholic Church say they apologized. He apologized to Galileo. Of course, Galileo couldn't hear him since he's been dead for more than 350 years now, that the church was wrong. Only 350 years. Of course, all the science was fixed in the next 100 years. And so the church could have been there 250 years ago. However, they're a little bit slow in admitting that some of the practices of the Catholic Church have not always been right up to date with modern times and with good behavior. So anyway, but because of studying those things, it was just horrendous trying to follow their logic, especially because I was trained through education, through graduate school, about astronomy. And I ran a planetarium, so I learned a lot of it out of books, but also from scholars, from teachers and experience using the telescope. It was hard for me to go back and forth, and I was fascinated by it afterwards, having a headache about this, because trying to follow their legitimate hard work, where they took great notes. Tycho Brahe recorded thousands of positions of stars over a couple of decades. He actually devised a device that would point at the horizon. He had it leveled, but he also had a circular device on it that he could raise the arm of it up and point to a star. And that device all could turn. And so he could measure the distance away from north, as far as where the star was away from north. And also he could measure the angle that the star was above the horizon. And so he recorded this. And he had thousands and thousands and thousands of recordings of stars and planets in notebooks, many, many, many notebooks. Well, when Tycho died, the last year of his life or so, Kepler worked for him. And Kepler was able to get his notebooks. He became the owner of those notebooks. It took a court battle for him to keep them. And from studying those calculations and those positions, Kepler was able to work out an amazing thing about the planets, the known planets at the time. He was able to figure out that the planets did not move in a circle about the sun, but that they moved in the shape of an ellipse about the sun, which revolutionized astronomy because it made sense. He was able to answer some questions about the sky that just confounded men, because until Kepler explained about the motion of the planets around the sun going in an ellipse, an elliptical orbit, and not in a circle, he finally was able to explain why the appearance in the sky at some parts of the year, when Mars seemed to go backwards in its flight around the sun, it was just an optical illusion. Mars wasn't going backwards at all. It had to do with other things going past Mars and made it look like Mars was backing up. So, but it was a fascinating challenge to go through some of the stuff in the books. There were pages I read five times, and I've almost never done that. Even in studying organic chemistry, I didn't study that hard to try to understand their thinking. And it's very hard when you, this is something if I were teaching, I would say my students, it's very hard when you know something to try to read someone else's work where they're saying things that you know can't be true, but you're trying to give them the benefit of the doubt because they didn't know what you know. And it was really, now I can understand why I got a headache trying to do that, because I really was trying to understand these brilliant men, and because they were basing things on what they could actually see at the time. And they didn't have the same knowledge that we do now. They didn't have the telescope. Galileo was the one who did have a telescope, and he benefited a great deal from the others because he actually wound up seeing things that no one else had ever seen. Galileo was the first person to ever find a moon of another planet. He discovered the four, they're called the Galilean moons, in some astronomy books, and He actually found four moons of Jupiter in 1609 or 1610. There is some debate about the exact date when he saw them, and he made drawings of them, of the positions of those moons. And those positions changed over a period of 2 months, and he made great sketches of the positions, and he identified them. And at the time, even though he improved the telescope and had fathers of the church, bishops, cardinals, look through the telescope and could see the moons, what they said to him was, "This is in this tube with glass. It is not in God's heaven. God's heaven does not have things flying around Jupiter. This creation here, made of glass and brass, is what contains those spots. They don't exist in the universe," which is pretty neat. That means you could watch something and see it over a period of time and see that it moved and still not believe it. So anyway, men have spent thousands of years making up incredible stories about the stars and about the moon and about the sun, and all kind of books written, you know, in the creation story. The sun and the moon are equal. Sun made for the daytime, moon made for the night. However, we know that that's not true, or at least that the words written in that book are not true, because the moon doesn't have any energy, and it doesn't have any fire, and it doesn't give off any light. It reflects the light from the sun. It's just like a big old knobby kind of mirror. And that's why we see moonlight. So anyway, that's my first little bit of a story about that.
I think I told you that I finished Galileo's Daughter, about 6 weeks ago, something like that. Uh-huh. And it was quite the book.
Yeah.
It really gave me a whole different picture of what I thought that time period was like. I knew the basic facts, but I didn't know the politics and the lives of women in that time and family life.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
I was fortunate in the 90s when I taught at the Calvert School in Baltimore. They had a wonderful, it was a private school, well endowed, very expensive, best salary I ever had as a teacher. And I ran their planetarium and I taught science in the first six grades. But each summer they offered like a scholarship to teachers. You could apply for it, and you could apply for it more than I received this a couple of times. They would give you as up to $2,000 to do something special during the summer that would improve your ability as a teacher. And what you had to do was come up with something that you could bring back to the school in the form of knowledge or something, and present it to the students so that, and so one summer, I applied for a grant for this scholarship to study Galileo and his life and to prepare a one-man stage presentation. And so I did that. And I spent the summer in a number of different libraries, the Enoch Pratt Library in downtown Baltimore, the Central Library. And also at Hood College in Frederick, at the time the girls' college, and I spent 4 weeks in each of those two libraries. Some days as much as 7 and 8 hours, looking through incredible number of volumes and taking notes. And so I wrote a one-man play about Galileo and about his discoveries and his battle with the church. And the play was more about his discoveries than the battle with the church. I didn't hardly mention the battles with the church because this was done for an elementary school audience and their parents. But it was a great experience. What a delight to have money. I was able to get a costume. I was able to have someone design a costume based on articles and pictures I had been able to gather, drawings of Galileo, paintings of Galileo. I had a wonderful costume. In my research of another Galileo was a redhead. So I dyed my beard and my hair. My hair was longer then. And I even studied with a French teacher at the school to learn to speak enough Italian to introduce myself in Italian. She was a wonderful linguist and taught me the Italian and practiced with me so that when I first began the show, I opened it by introducing myself in Italian. And you know, with mi chiamo Galileo Galilei, and then realizing I had a longer sentence, and then as the person performing, realizing that the kids could not understand me because they didn't speak Italian, and then changing to English, and it worked. The kids, you know, they liked the performance and stuff like that. I was able to show them through I had students from my drama club that I had created here. One of my favorite people, really good kid. I made some slides of Galileo's drawings of the moons of Jupiter, and with using a slide projector, that could be shown from the back of the auditorium onto a large screen behind me, and to show a picture of Galileo of Jupiter and the moons in different positions. Each slide changed and the moons moved. And anyway, I had lots of gadgets that I was able to build. I had a 14-foot semicircle that I used to illustrate pendulum motion using bowling balls, and I called them cannonballs, saying that I had gone to the armory and borrowed some cannonballs, and told stories about like that. As Galileo, I never dropped these off of the Leaning Tower of Pisa. That's not true. Can you imagine if I had my assistant 500 feet down below and I dropped the ball down and he was supposed to time how long it took to fall? I might have crushed him or something. So, you know, and kids loved that because I stood near the front of the stage with a bowling ball in my hand as if I was going to drop it down on my friend Pedro down there. They thought that was funny. And then I explained a lot of the science. Anyway, it was a big hit and it was $2,000 well spent. It would have cost a lot more except that the man who built the 14-foot semicircle happened to be someone I knew who owned the Reisterstown Lumber Company. And he also owned the mill associated with the company. And he made that beautiful, beautiful semicircle for me. And I had it for a number of years. And I think it's still someplace in the old Frederick High School, because I moved to Frederick High School from that other school. And it was in a storage room there. And I left it when I left Frederick High School and retired. So I don't know whatever happened to it. But anyway, it was such a great opportunity to do something like that. And a wonderful private institution. Of course, the public school would not give me $2,000 in the summer to study on my own and create a play. But that is the benefit of having wealthy people fund education, if you can have something like that. And it was fun to be able to teach the kids about astronomy and to introduce them to some real legendary people, Galileo, my portrayal.
You've been listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour. We're close to halfway through the show. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stasi Okalski. And I have a
theme today is the poetry of astronomy. And what were you going to say, Stash?
You know, once you get me started, it's almost impossible to turn me off. I do have a poem that I would like to contribute.
Okay.
You know, okay. And this is mine. And when you said this the other day, and then last night my wife said to me, I thought you were going to do something about poetry. And I said, yeah. She said, are you going to do a poem? And I said, yeah. And it was like 8 o'clock last night. She said, do you have one? I said, no, I'm going to write one now. So I did. This is short one. Okay. The moon shines most nights, but it doesn't have its own light. It is cold and lonely and has no life. It shines, but only because it reflects another's glory. For years, we have watched as it changes its phases. It looks like an ad for a product. It sometimes amazes. For eons, men have tried to give it meaning. But now, we know it is only a thing, a sphere, a rock, that moves around our Earth. No life, no magic, nothing, just the thing.
Wow. That's kind of sad, Stash.
It is, but it's better to know something than to imagine it. In the past, there have been stories about certain saints were assigned to move the planets, and the stars did things because of the influence of spiritual gods, and it is so much better to rely on science and on things that make sense than to imagine, you know, imaginary people and gods and silly stuff like that. It's fun to have stories, but it's better to have reality. So I know that the moon is just a cold, lonely place. Nothing lives there. No one should care what goes on there, except people are crazy enough that they want to go and stand on the moon and say, look what I did, I stood on the moon. Yay, yay, yay. And
the curmudgeon.
Well, I know, you know, I am.
The moon can't really be lonely because there's nobody there to be lonely. Lonely is a emotional.
No, that's right. The moon, and so the moon, when people say something about it being lonely, it's imaginary because we have a hard time not wanting to put spiritual stuff on things and think that there's, ooh, that chair. Every time I look at that chair, I think it moves a little bit. It must be Grandpa's ghost sitting down in that. I remember as a kid being fascinated being in a house by myself sometimes when I was alone and imagining all the things that would be happening. You know, creaky stairs and the settling of the house.
I went a different route, which will not surprise you.
No.
So this is in the realm of the imaginary, my poem. I did not write this myself. This is a poem from E.E. Cummings. And Cummings was a classic scholar, but he served as an ambulance driver in World War I in France. And he was a fairly young man at that point. And what comes through in this poem that I'm going to read is Cummings' ambivalence for the heroism of warriors. So being a classic scholar, of course, he knew all about the great heroes of Greece and Rome. And it was not until he got to the battlefields in France that some of the horrific realities of warfare began to be much clearer to him. And he became kind of alienated from his fellow GIs and from Americans in general, while becoming absorbed in French culture and affection for the French people that he was meeting. And but really complicated his relationship to the army was his refusal to hate Germans. And that eventually led to his imprisonment for a while during the war. And I didn't know that. I had read a fair amount of E.E. Cummings poetry from the time I was in junior high school on up. Have several volumes on my shelf, but I didn't know this social side to him, this quasi-political side to him. So this poem is E.E. Cummings' commentary on war and its intersection with love and affinity between souls. So this is E.E. Cummings' retelling of the tale of celestial beings, in this case, Mars or Aries, and Venus or Aphrodite, to use both the Roman and the Greek names for this god and goddess. And Aphrodite was the husband of Vulcan, or Hephaestus, called the blacksmith in the pantheon of Olympians. So in the Greek telling of the tale, Hephaestus discovers the betrayal of his wife. He traps the lovers, Aphrodite and Ares, in a metallic but gossamer-like net. He's a metalsmith, a blacksmith. And with his skill, he creates this gossamer metal net and traps them inside it in the midst of their lovemaking, and then holds them there and calls his brothers and sisters, the entire Olympic pantheon, to ridicule and shame the couple within the net. And it's only, I don't know, days or something later that his brother uncle Poseidon convinces Hephaestus to free the lovers, and then only with the promise of penalties that they will have to pay dearly for their transgression. So this is E.E. Cummings on love and war. In heavenly realms of Hellas dwelt two very different sons of Zeus, one handsome, strong, and born to dare, a fighter to his eyelashes, the other cunning, ugly, lame, but as you'll shortly comprehend, a marvelous artificer. Now ugly was the husband of, as happens every now and then upon a merely human plane, someone completely beautiful. And beautiful, who, truth to sing, could never quite tell right from wrong, took brother fearless by the eyes and did the deed of joy with him. Then cunning forged a web so subtle, air is comparatively crude, an indestructible, occult super snare of resistless metal. And stealing toward the blissful pair, skillfully wafted over themselves this implacable unthing. Next, our illustrious scientist petitions the celestial host to scrutinize his handiwork. They, summoned by that savage yell from shining realms of regions dark, laugh long at beautiful and brave, wildly who rage, vainly who strive, and being finally released, flee one another like the pest. Thus did immortal jealousy quell divine generosity. Thus reason vanquished instinct, and matter became the slave of mind. Thus virtue triumphed over vice, and beauty bowed to ugliness, and logic thwarted life. And thus, but look around you, friends and foes, my tragic tale concludes herewith. Soldier, beware of Mrs. Smith. It's a bit of misogyny there by E.E. Cummings for Aphrodite and Mars or Aries. I do love E.E. Cummings poems, but I never knew much about the man himself. And I spent most of my time preparing for today's radio show was learning more background about E.E. Cummings, because I had a whole pile of E.E. Cummings poems about celestial bodies and the sun and life that really moved me until I started discovering things about the man himself that really cast a different light on all of that.
You thought he was strange?
Well, I always knew he was, I knew he was strange just from reading his poetry. I knew that as a young teenager. I read him in elementary school, but those were poems for children. So
yeah,
that was different. For
a long time when I was younger, I used to get E.E. Cummings and A.A. Milne mixed up.
It must have been very confusing.
As a young person, you're learning names. A.A. Milne, E.E. Cummings, two letters of the same. And we'd get, I'd say, wait a minute, which one is which?
Did you have the books?
Did you have
your own copies?
No. We didn't have a whole lot of books when I was little. The only books we had in the house, we had a few books in the house. My most precious books that were in the house when I was young, really young, before I got my first library card, which I got when I was probably 8 or 9, where I get introduced to storytelling. But my father had picked up someplace on a job, a box with tiny little books, and those books were Edgar Allan Poe. And so I had tiny copies of Poe in this little box that was kept in our underneath our telephone in the little in the cabinet. And I found them one day and asked my dad if I could read them. He said, sure, I brought them home in case somebody would like to read them, and they were really nice, and that's where I became interested in Poe, because each one of those books was a separate story by Poe, and I became fascinated with it. And then when I started going to the library on Ann Street, which was just right down the street from me, and then two blocks south. My first experience with storytelling was with a lady who wore a house dress just like my mother. I think that was probably normal kind of clothing back in the 40s. And the lady was, I thought she was old, but she was probably middle-aged. And she would sit in front of a group of little kids, and we would sit on the floor, and she had to sit on a little stool. Actually, it was not a stool. It was kind of a seat. I don't know what you call it. Like, it didn't have a well, anyway, I want to call it tufted, but I don't know. It had, it was real soft padding that she sat on, but it wasn't just a pillow or something. It was like embroidered, I guess. Anyway, and she would tell us a story. And I was amazed. It was the first time I'd heard anybody tell a story like that. I heard my father tell stories. My dad was a great storyteller. He would tell sometimes wild stories. But he, and usually it was when we were in the car going someplace. He would entertain us by telling a story. But this woman would paint pictures with words. And she would say, close your eyes and listen to what I say and see if you can imagine where we are. And it was just wonderful because she was so soft and gentle. And sometimes in a story, she could be loud. She could make noises and things, but it was very exciting. And every Wednesday for, I know for months, I went to that storytelling on a Wednesday afternoon after school. And it was so fascinating. And I know it made my mom happy that I was going to the library instead of going out the street and running around, busting my knees or breaking windows or something like that. And it made me happy because it gave me a love for books. It was at that library that I got my first time I read Moby Dick. I think I was 10 years old when I first got a copy of Moby Dick and read it. It took me a long time to get through that. It was difficult. I have read it numerous times since then. It is one of my favorite books, and it is tedious. And I've told kids that I think it's worthwhile reading, but don't expect it to be super duper happy joppy, all this stuff. It's tedious, it's difficult. Difficult to read about how hard it was to be on a whaling ship and all the serious stuff that went on with these men. But anyway, that storyteller really made a big difference in my life. I have loved libraries ever since, and I'm still a pretty good reader. I still read a lot.
I know you as a more than a pretty good reader.
Well,
but thank you so much.
I think it would be a terrible thing not to be able to read.
Yeah, I do too. Well, I have another poem that is very different from the one I just read by E.E. Cummings and has a different feel, but it too is about the universe and humanity's place in the universe. This one is by Nikki Giovanni,
ooh, who
is a poet and an author. And I came to this one because it's from her collection of essays, Sacred Cows and Other Edibles. And we can argue about whether this is a poem, but for me, this is a prose poem. And it's written in paragraphs, but each line is connected by a series of dots to the next line. So when I read it, it feels like a poem to me. It's called A Ribbon on the Maypole. I first heard Nikki Giovanni live at Frostburg University, probably about 1980, some possibly as late as 1990, but she made a really big impression on me. And I've been hearing about Nikki Giovanni and reading her poetry for a long time because several of my aunts, as well as my parents, talked about her and had books by her on their shelves. So I thought of her as a friend in a way, you know, a literary friend. but I had never heard her voice before. And she made a big impression when I finally got to hear her. So this prose poem is dedicated to Paul Marshall. Now, Paul Marshall was a fellow author and friend. Her name is spelled P-A-U-L-E with an E on the end, but the E is silent. And she named herself in a way. She was born with the name Valenza Pauline Burke in Brooklyn, New York, 1929. She lived to be 90 years old and was a great influence on a lot of other poets and novelists and essayists. So Paul Marshall discovered the poetry of Paul Laurence Dunbar at age of 12 or 13 and promptly changed her name to be Paul with an E on the end to distinguish herself, and went on to become a beloved and prolific author in her own right. So this is a fairly long poem, and I'm just going to read two excerpts from it. But I really like it. A ribbon on the maypole for Paul Marshall. We can explain the generosity of the sun by talking of expanding gases. We can chemically legitimize water as the union of hydrogen and oxygen. We can see a definite, undeniable urge for flowers to turn to any source of light. But that is only observation of behavior. We also know slaves identified with masters, that Jews clothed to authority, that women still love men. So much of knowledge is not only empirical, but axiomatic. Yet the scientific gathering of data speaks exclusively to craft. There must also be art if we are to yield reason. Anthropologically speaking, we are incorrect to accept the concept that human male stood to weld and brandish weapons. A more gentle data would allow us security in the reasoning that human female stood to nurture and embrace. Psychologically speaking, we are unimpressed that human genes are the determinant of human responsibility. We would agree, rather, with the American Constitution that all peoples are created equal and are endowed with the inviolate right to perceive the limitlessness of their possibilities unencumbered by another's view of racial characteristics, gender responsibilities, or religious comforts. Law demands that we refrain from unacceptable behavior. Justice whispers to us the necessity of risk. To those who ask, in this space age, high tech, fast-paced, materialistic, immediately gratifying society of ours, what is the purpose of art? We would reply, cave woman has answered that question in defiance of damp, cold, and dark habitat against men and animals who would make of her their evening meal. Despite a lack of adequate tools or knowledge of their proper application on clay walls in tune with the rhythm of her crackling fire and crying babies, she took the time to sketch a saber tooth, to etch the power of a mammoth, to exhibit awe that the sun warms, the waters flow, the winds bend trees. We turn to literature for the emotional gathering of data, not to say that war still occurs, but to show the continuing human price for human impatience, not to show that hunger still exists, but to exacerbate unremitting greed from human relationships, not to erect signs saying mine, but to wrap a ribbon on the maypole. We turn to literature because our greatest literature teaches us in the beginning was the word. And it is the word that will lift the ignorance of the dark ages from our spirits and cast our possibilities to the heavens. It is words that will set us free.
Nice.
Isn't that amazing?
I mean, it's nice. Yeah.
So many poems.
I like poetry too. When I was in the Army, I wrote poems. One of the things I sometimes when I've been at the VA, I've tended to ask people if, you know, other veterans, did you write poems when you were in?
And what did they say?
I haven't. I've been tempted to, but you know, these guys are a lot of the VA people I meet, you know, when I've gone with my brother, are guys who've been in war and stuff. And I am reluctant to engage them in conversation because I don't want to, I have experience where it brings up bad memories sometimes, not mm-hmm. always, but sometimes. So I hesitate to talk about service time. But anyway, when I was in, I remember 15 or 20 poets that I came across. Guys that, you know, I remember talking to guys about stuff and finding out that they wrote a poem. You know, it's can I hear one? And, you know, and they would be glad to share with you if it was in a quiet place where they weren't going to get laughed at or anything. Some of them were very good. And I wrote a lot of poems in the Army. I had a collection of poems, hundreds of poems that I've written. They live in a leather bag someplace with lots of other memorabilia of mine, which disappeared. And I have no idea where that leather, it was actually a leather, like a school teacher's bag. And I would love to be able to find that someday, but it's gone. It's been gone for a long time.
I'm glad you're still writing poetry to make up for that, those missing.
Oh, books. Well, yeah. Not as much as I used to. I used to love to do that. I used to write about, you know, I'm just in the middle of school day, sometimes I'd write a poem based on something that happened in a class. You know? It was fun.
Neat.
But yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I think it's time to close the show.
We've been on for, 50 some minutes. So.
Okay.
It was good. I enjoyed this very much.
Yeah. You know. Stars and poetry. What's not to like?
Right. I know.
Hello. Okay. Well, I'm going to close out the show.
I know, because you're going to run anyway.
Yeah.
You got things to set out on the curb.
That's one way to put it. You've been listening to the Enlightened Radio Storytelling Hour at enlightenedradio.org. We are independent community radio broadcasting from Bolivar, West Virginia, Hagerstown, Maryland, and Martinsburg, West Virginia. I'm Fanny Crawford.
And I'm Stosh Ziolkowski.
We are offering you, our listeners, a window into the world of storytelling by traditional and non-traditional tellers, encouraging our listening community to share, preserve, and expand all of our stories. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for John Case up next with
Country music, you know.